Members, we're going to get started. We do not have a quorum, but we'll at least begin the meeting here and welcome Representative Holberg to the committee. Representative Holberg, I can't move your bill just yet, but let's begin. Representative Holberg is presenting Senate File 1212, Senate File 1212. And welcome to the committee, Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a pretty simple bill that expands the definition of a patient relative to health records. And I do need an oral amendment to the bill when you're in a position to be able to do that. But just for discussion purposes, on page 2, line 6, before the word adult, insert the word surviving, in that we do not want all adult children to have access to their parents' medical records, but only in the instance in which the actual individual's records is that they're deceased, and that a surviving child would be able to access those records. And so it's a pretty simple change. In the interest of time, I understand there is a gentleman that does want to speak in favor of this bill. Maybe while waiting for a quorum, we could take that testimony. And
okay, Representative Holberg, we've noted the oral amendment. We can't move it yet because we don't have a quorum, but we will when we get a chance to. And if your testifier could come down now, let's
Mr. Chair, he's not my testifier, but he
I'm sorry.
Requested
okay.
With the
Mr. Garrity. Hope I'm pronouncing that right. We have one testifier signed up to testify. Anybody else wishing to testify for you? Are you Mr. Garrity?
Yes.
Okay, please, if you could come up and state your full name for the record, who you represent, and then proceed with your testimony.
My name is Michael C. Garrity, and I'm representing myself. And I understand this bill passed unanimously in the Senate, so I don't know why I'm here, but I'm here. I'm here because I ran into the circumstances where I think the change to the law is necessary. Last year, my 95-year-old mother got out of a rehab center, and I took her home, and after I got her home, I noticed she had a bandage on her arm. I took the bandage off, and she had a terrible laceration on her arm. I found out later that laceration had occurred some days ago in the rehab center. They had not notified me, nor had they properly treated it. So I wanted to investigate the circumstances of that wound, and after she died, and I was unable to. My mother had a small estate. There was no probate, and under the current Minnesota law, there's no access unless you're the surviving parent of a patient or a surviving spouse. And so under these circumstances, the family members, if they just want to investigate and find out what happened to the parent after death, if there was some maltreatment in a facility, they're shut out unless they bring a probate. Under current law, you call a facility and they say, are you the personal representative of the estate? No, there's no probate. So bottom line is you'd have to open a probate. Now, most middle-class family members aren't going to want to open a probate so they can access these records. So I think I was just dealing with this recently, and I found out from a probate lawyer that this change was coming. So I just want to say it's a very good idea. And also, I want to also point out that the HHS, their Office of Civil Rights in Chicago, is doing rulemaking on this right now, and they're making a similar change so that family members can have access. And also, they had some rulemaking back in 2002 when HIPAA came out, and in that they said that family members should have access to the records of a decedent. So I just want to make it real clear that there's a very strong need for this. I'm a probate practitioner, and I see this quite a bit where people want to find out what happened and what happened to the loved one, and they're shut off, basically. And the providers are using as a means to keep them from looking at what happened.
Very good.
That's
Mr. Garrity, thank you for your testimony. Members, I'm going to bring the meeting officially to order. Now that we have a quorum, and I will also officially move Senate File 1212 that it be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. And I will also move the oral amendment on line 2.6, after the comma following spouse, we are inserting the word surviving. And I will move that oral amendment on behalf of Representative Holberg now. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails and the oral amendment is adopted. And we are now on the bill as amended. Members, questions? Are there any other people in the audience wanting to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that Senate File 1212 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Civil Law as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails, and the bill is passed on to civil law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. Next up, we have House File 2341, Representative Pepin. Okay, and just a note, as we're going through the bills, we are going through seven bills. We are not meeting tonight. We are asking testifiers to please keep their testimony to about 2 minutes. I sense approval from the committee members on both sides here. So we will keep things moving. Representative Pepin, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 2341 that it be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. And proceed with your bill, Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Representative Gutwald. Well, in interest of time, I'll keep my remarks really short and then turn it over. Basically, what my bill does is that when RU486 or any other drug or chemical that is designed for inducing an abortion, whenever that drug is used, a physician must be in the same room. There must be the presence of a physician. And that's the gist of it. But I'm going to turn it over to Jordan Harris from MCCL to talk about it further.
Very good. Ms. Harris, welcome to the committee. Please state your full name for the record, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jordan Harris, and I'm here on behalf of Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life, a grassroots organization with over 200 chapters and more than 70,000 member families. And we have this single issue of protecting innocent human life. So this legislation before you today seeks to protect women by requiring that a physician be physically present and in the same room of the woman when administering RU486. Though approved by the FDA in 2000, RU486 is known to be a drug that carries significant risks. It is because of these safety concerns that RU486 is not legal in Canada, a country known for much more liberal abortion policies. The FDA's approval, however, came with significant restrictions, including that only a physician can administer the drug. In other words, the FDA believed that the drug was dangerous enough and the physician's role important enough that RU486 cannot be gotten at a pharmacy, but only directly from a physician. Since its FDA approval, at least 14 women in the United States have died after taking RU486, and more than 2,200 adverse effects have been reported. Many of these side effects of RU486, including prolonged pain, cramping, heavy bleeding, nausea, diarrhea, vomiting, and fever, can mask more serious complications, such as infection, hemorrhage, and incomplete abortion, that can sometimes lead to death. Some of these complications may even mask a ruptured ectopic pregnancy, whose symptoms mirror the expected side effects of RU486, and also could lead to death. Currently in Minnesota, some chemical abortions are being performed without a physician physically present in the same room with the woman seeking the abortion. Instead, the woman is being administered the RU486 abortion drug by a physician in a different location using closed-circuit video conferencing and who remotely opens a locked drawer which contains the RU486 abortion drug. These webcam abortions are happening at the Rochester Planned Parenthood Clinic. Not only is this revelation shocking, but it shows a real disregard for the health and safety of women, given the especially dangerous complications and risks associated with the drug. When RU486 is administered via webcam, the woman is not able to have a physical exam to verify and ensure that she has no factors making RU486 a potentially deadly procedure for her. Physician involvement, as well as the patient-doctor relationship, is critical in helping to mitigate the risk of very serious complications occurring as a result of RU486. At least six states, including North Dakota and South Dakota, have already enacted such a law to this effect, and other states like Wisconsin are currently working on legislation that's similar to this. RU-486 is a dangerous drug, and the associated risks have the potential to increase without a physician being physically present to administer the drug. Women deserve better than a webcam abortion, and for this reason, please support House File 2341. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay, we also have additional testifiers. Dr. Janet Strathy from Park Nicollet. And I understand we have at least two other testifiers against the bill, and if they could come up as well, that would be good. Welcome to the committee. Please state your full name for the record, who you represent, and then proceed with your testimony.
My name is Dr. Jeanette Strathy, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Medical Association, Representative Gottwalt, members of the committee. I've practiced obstetrics and gynecology in St. Louis Park for 27 years, and in those years, I have personally cared for women and their families in almost every triumph and tragedy possible as relates to human reproduction. Counseling women considering pregnancy termination is challenging and heartbreaking because of the innumerable medical and personal scenarios possible. This bill will affect women's health in Minnesota, but not the way the authors may think. This bill will not increase the safety of medical-induced abortion. The risk of a medical abortion comes not when the pill is swallowed, but when the expected result occurs hours or days later. Requiring physician presence for the administration of the medication will not alter this risk one way or the other. Micromanaging specific dates of appointments will also not increase safety. Yes, data has shown that 11 or 14, I'll take 14, women have died as a result of this medication, but that's out of 1.6 million users. This bill will create a barrier for women in rural Minnesota who will not have access to medical abortion. Targeting telemedicine in this manner will start a precedent that could affect other legal and appropriate therapies. This bill will make felons of almost every OBGYN in the state of Minnesota who chooses to treat tubal, corneal, or cesarean section scar pregnancies with methotrexate, the other medicine. This is a chemotherapy drug used to treat placental cancer. Pregnancies that develop in the wrong place cannot grow to viability and are life-threatening to the mother. This medication can avoid surgery, including hysterectomy, and thus preserve for future fertility. This cancer medication must be prepared under special circumstances by trained staff and then administered by cancer nurses in cancer centers. Obstetricians are personally not present when this medication is administered. I have personally broken this law twice so far this year in the circumstances described. This bill will create a delay in care that will result in some women missing the 7-week gestation time frame to choose the safer, less expensive, and less invasive medical abortion option. Some women may not be able to make the necessary travel arrangements for surgical abortion and find themselves with no choice but to carry the pregnancy to term, regardless of their personal circumstances and risk.
Ms. Strathy, how much longer?
This bill will not make medical abortion safer. It will, however, prevent non-surgical treatment of ectopic pregnancies depending on the OBGYN's willingness to risk felony charges or travel to the cancer center to watch their patient get a shot.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Our next testifier is Dr. Jim House. Dr. House, welcome to the committee. Please state your full name for the record, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony.
Dr. James House. I am a member of the Minnesota State Medical Association. I'm a retired professor of orthopedic surgery at the University of Minnesota Medical School, but continue to teach medical students and residents at the VA Medical Center. I served as the medical director of telemedicine at the university hospital for many years, involved in research regarding the effective use of telemedicine in rural Minnesota. When we started in 1995, the process was very complex and expensive and was considered experimental. At this time, it has been confirmed that the doctor-patient interaction over telemedicine is fully equivalent to face-to-face visit and is becoming more widely employed for many medical situations and has been shown to be particularly valuable for persons in rural areas. I'm here to testify on the importance of telemedicine in the 21st century and to urge you to not place into statute a law that would ban any medical procedure using telemedicine, as presented in House File 2341. Telemedicine technology has made it possible for a physician to provide needed medical consultation and make appropriate treatment decisions without requiring the person to travel to the hospital or clinic for evaluation. I will briefly give you examples of current uses to help you understand its efficacy.
Dr. House, I do want to point out we're trying to keep testimony about...
I will have less than 2 minutes total.
Okay, thank you.
I assure you. In the emergency management of a stroke patient, a proper diagnosis is essential to allow the administration of life-saving clotbuster drugs, which can only be given in the case of a stroke caused by a blood clot to the brain, but not when there's bleeding in the brain. Consultation over telemedicine has been used successfully, enabling a neurology specialist many miles away to evaluate a patient in rural emergency rooms to provide the needed expert opinion so the life-saving treatment can be given safely. Telemedicine has been particularly useful in child psychiatry, enabling timely consultation with children in rural areas of the state where the needed specialists are unavailable and long delays could prove harmful. Telemedicine counseling with the child facilitates treatment decisions, including the administration of drugs for managing their condition. Telemedicine is also employed by VA hospitals in the intensive care unit and providing consultation for veterans with post-traumatic stress disorders and making important treatment decisions, including the use of medication. Since many medications have been and need to be prescribed by a telemedicine, when the physician cannot be in the room with the person, to restrict the prescription of one type of medication as proposed in this statute would set an inappropriate precipice. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Hellis. We'll hear from Ms. Law. Welcome to the committee. Please state your full name for the record, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Karen Law, and I'm the Executive Director of Pro-Choice Resources. Pro-Choice Resources is a local nonprofit. We provide comprehensive sexuality education for youth. We train teachers across the state, and we also provide abortion funding for women in need. I'm here today to testify in opposition to House File 2341. Make no mistake, this bill is not about protecting or saving women's lives. We understand the strategies at play here. This is a whittling away at abortion access for women. Telemedicine uses webcams and other electronic technology to connect doctors with other medical personnel and the patient at remote locations. It has been used for years to bring specialist health care to people who live in remote areas and who do not have access to a provider. As of 2008, 95% of Minnesota counties had no abortion provider. 62% of Minnesota women live in these counties. The intention of this bill is clear. It creates an unnecessary barrier for women who do not live in areas where an abortion provider practices. Women will have to travel hundreds of miles, which is not in her best interest or safety, to access a medical procedure that is her constitutionally protected right. This adds to the cost of abortion care, particularly for rural women and many low to moderate income women who cannot afford the additional time off, travel costs, creating continued disparities in access to those who can and cannot afford safe and legal abortion services. An abortion via telemedicine gives women the ability to decide what's best for her and her family. If you are truly concerned about women's health and safety regulations regarding this procedure, I hope you will do your due diligence and read all of the research. Research which, according to the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists in 2001, concludes the provision of medical abortion through telemedicine is effective and acceptability high among women who choose this model. Acceptability meaning no increased adverse reactions to women receiving this type of care. The continued restrictions and access to abortion care and making the procedure harder to obtain does not improve women's health. In fact, you are harming our most vulnerable populations, poor women, rural women, women in domestic violence situations, and women of color. people and communities you represent. With this bill, you are continuing to usurp women's fundamental rights, the autonomy of doctors, nurses, and other medical providers to provide safe, legal abortion care to all women. Simply, you're risking the welfare of women, not protecting them. So the members of this committee, I respectfully ask that you vote against House File number 2341. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Law. Members, questions to any of the testifiers? Any questions? Representative Liebling.
Well, it's not so much a question, Mr. Chair, but I just want to say to those who've come and testified in opposition to this bill, we know that these days that takes a lot of courage. And I just want to thank you for that, because it's clear to me that this bill is not about women's health, that this is simply another attempt to stop abortions, to stop women from exercising their legal right to decide what to do with their own bodies, and in fact that this kind of a bill does make women less safe. And I just wanted to say that I do appreciate those who are willing to come and testify against this, because we have seen in some situations that can be a personally risky thing to do. So I just want to make that comment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for Dr. Strathy.
Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Strathy, I'm just curious, do you regularly perform abortions?
Dr. Strathy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in the place that I work, we are involved with medically indicated abortions and not elective abortions. I refer my patients to Planned Parenthood.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. You know, we as a society do everything we can to save lives at all stages. And as a doctor, of course, you know the importance of saving lives. I'm a little disappointed to hear your testimony when you say only was 11 or 14 women have died in this procedure out of 1.5 million. When as a doctor, as a physician, it's your obligation to save lives at all costs. In my own opinion, even the unborn, especially the children, but for certainly the mothers as well. So it is disheartening for you to dismiss even, I forget what number you said, 11 or 14 women because of this procedure. So I think it's a very important bill, and I believe that this is for women's safety, and I support this wholeheartedly. We must protect all life at all stages. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Grimhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Jordan, this is for Jordan Harris. Would you respond to some of the state...
Representative Grinhagen, if you could speak into the microphone, please.
Oh.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Would you respond to some of the statements, like one of the statements that was made by the testifiers, that this is going to make all telemedicine illegal, if I understood that correctly?
Ms. Harris.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Grinhagen, one of the things that is really important to address is telemedicine does a lot of really great things. We heard talk about stroke patients and treating heart disease and things like that, all very, very important. Currently in state law, physician is required to perform abortions. Only a physician can perform them. If you're having a surgical abortion, a physician would be in the room performing that abortion. Nothing in this bill makes a chemical abortion illegal or outlaws it. In fact, it just says that if you're going to be doing them, the physician needs to be on site and can't be located hundreds of miles away, potentially in a different city. So there's nothing in this bill that would prevent any rural Minnesota woman from having an abortion. The physician would just need to be on site, which, considering what we're dealing with here, is not too much to ask.
Representative Grinhagen.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. But it doesn't make other types of telemedicine illegal. This bill doesn't make other types of telemedicine illegal.
Ms. Harris.
Mr. Chair, this bill doesn't do anything, quite frankly, about telemedicine other than that if you're going to do a chemical abortion, a physician needs to be present. So any other use of telemedicine is not in any way affected. And I know there was some discussion of chemotherapeutic drugs and things like that. This only applies to when drugs or chemicals like RU486 are being used to induce an abortion, not to treat any other condition or whatever.
Mr. Chair, just a question for the good doctor. who testified?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Stratton?
Yep. Stratton, yeah. No, not the man.
Dr. House.
What is it? I identify people, male and female. Sorry about that. No, or man and lady, one of the two.
I'm Dr. House, the one not on television.
Okay, all right, good. Mr. Chair, Dr. House.
Representative Grunhagen.
You know, I'm not a doctor, okay? But I've I own an insurance agency. I've done jail ministry for 13 years. I've talked to a lot of people. I closely know a lot of health care workers and doctors, and I've talked to them a lot. And one of the things, you know, so just, and I've studied the abortion issue quite a bit. I'm pro-life, obviously. But, you know, one of the things is that there is a potential for complications with this type of drug. And to me, it just seems reasonable that by being able to see a doctor versus something over the telemed, if you do develop some type of complication, at least you're in a situation where you can go back and see that doctor face to face. And to me, that's just a reasonable safety for the woman who's taking this abortion, that if she does develop a complication, she's not going to some doctor that she didn't see before who didn't participate in this procedure.
There are really two parts of the answer.
Dr. House.
One is clearly the decision-making and the experience in decision-making and the interaction with the patient, the discussion in detail of the risks and options and all the alternatives is one part, and that can be fully taken care of by telemedicine. The administration of this particular drug, its effects are 36 hours later, maybe 48 hours later, 24 hours later. They're not within 6 or 8 hours, and so the presence of the physician when the drug is administered is totally immaterial. The important part is the relationship that the physician established with that patient when the decision was made.
Dr. Streffy, I also wanted to give you an opportunity. You looked like you wanted to respond earlier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald. I just wanted to comment that I can assure you that I have the utmost respect for life, and I also have the utmost respect for the 14 women who may have died of complications of a medical abortion. Until someone else can take the risk of pregnancy for a woman who's carrying a pregnancy, and it is not without risk, until someone else can take that risk for her, I personally believe that it needs to be her choice. And so I would encourage anyone to try to preserve the opportunity for life, but I cannot put myself in their shoes, nor can you. And so until you can take their risk, I feel it needs to be the woman's choice. For 24 weeks, it is totally up to them.
Okay, we have Representative Mack, Representative McElfatrick, Representative Murphy, Representative France, and Representative Barrett. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the testifiers. I genuinely appreciate the discussion. Mr. Chair, I would ask for a roll call on this bill.
Roll call has been requested on the vote on the bill. Representative Mack, were you done? Okay. Representative McElfatrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be brief. I only have a comment rather than a question, perhaps directed mostly to Dr. House. I find it very interesting and ironic that you focused your comments largely on how important telemedicine is to rural medicine, but I believe it was mentioned that these procedures are being done now in Rochester, which probably has a greater proportion concentration of doctors than any other per square mile than any other place in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I guess I have a question for Representative Pepin. As I think about this piece of legislation and the comments that are being made about telemedicine in particular, I have concerns that while this is focused on one medication and one procedure, that we are by discussion or vote beginning to articulate a standard from our perspective on telemedicine. so that while this piece of legislation is focused on one procedure and one medication, we may be, in fact, indicting telemedicine and procedures that are done on a regular basis that may be more risky, more invasive, and in an unintended way, setting a standard that will eliminate or restrict the use of telemedicine going forward. And I'm wondering if you've been able to think about that, or you've considered that as you've contemplated the legislation.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy. Well, Ms. Harris talked about it a little bit, that there already is a standard for surgical abortion that a physician has to be in the room. And so I just feel very strongly that in an instance like this, and there are not just physical consequences of abortion, there's also emotional consequences of abortion. And I just feel strongly that when someone decides to go that route, that there's a physician there that's examining them, that's helping them work through the process. I think that's a little different than other areas, stroke or whatnot, where I don't know that the emotional issues are as attached to it, and there's not a standard in place already for the, you know, like I said, surgical abortion. The doctor already has to be there. I don't think it sets a different standard, and I support the idea of telemedicine. I understand that and appreciate that for rural areas, but I think that when it's such an issue as this, I think it's really important, considering that there have been 14 deaths using this medication, that the woman really understands the consequences and that there's a physician there should anything happen.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Pepin, thank you for that. When I first started practicing surgical nursing now a long time ago, patients were admitted to the hospital the night before the procedure, and I would be able to go up and visit the patient before they had their surgical procedure, and then they would have their surgery the next day, and then they would be discharged back to a medical unit or a surgical unit, and I could go back and visit them again, and I was the nurse in the operating room. So much of surgery has changed now. Patients come in the morning of the surgery, they go home the same day of the surgery, and the relationship between the patient and the provider exists outside the walls of the building. And so much, I remember the first time I had to write a care plan in college, I got an F on my first care plan. It was a surgical care plan because I was only worried about three problems. They said write for three problems, but really a post-op patient has so many problems, right? So my instructor said, your patient would die. And she gave me an F, and she gave me a chance to do it over, right? Surgery.
Representative Murphy, I was just remembering my daughter telling the same story.
Okay. So. Surgery is, invasive, whether it is with a knife or a laser or with a scope or with medication. And part of that happens in a place with a provider. But a lot of what happens at home, afterwards, or in a recovery room or in another room when the provider's not there. And when we think about telemedicine and the relationship between the provider and the patient, and they may be in different states, not even in Minnesota, that is like, it's going to be so critical to our ability to deliver health care in the United States as the workforce continues to shrink. And I am really worried that in an unintended way, this piece of legislation is going to constrain that area of medical practice and that area of health care going forward. And so I want to be on the record about that. I'm worried about this piece of legislation for that reason, in addition to, you know, my concerns from a different perspective as a woman. And I'll just leave it at that.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's see here. I guess I just have a few comments to make. You know, every time we talk about abortion here in these Health and Human Services committees, I sit back and I listen to both sides of the aisle talk about life and the woman's choice and to choose. And, I can't help but think every time we talk about abortion that it's another sad day. Here we are deciding who's going to live and who's going to die. And on April 22nd, we're going to be experiencing Earth Day. And on Earth Day, we're going to be talking about how we need to save the Earth and we need to plant some trees and we need to grow the ground. And yet we don't have any problem talking about taking the life of an innocent child. It's very sad, very sad. each unborn child is a human being, and I believe has the right to life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. And each one of us here today have the opportunity to sit at this table or be in the crowd and listen or be at the testifying table and offer your words, your testimony, because your mom chose to give you life. And I'm reading an article that was on Women's Health at MSNBC.com, and it was dated back in 2011. And it's talking about the telemedicine, where, let's see here. Through the end of April of 2011, 2,207 adverse events had been associated with the drug, according to FDA records. They included 14 deaths, 612 hospitalizations, some 339 patients had blood loss severe enough to require transfusions, and 256 infections were reported, including 48 serious infections. But the FDA officials are quick to point out that it's not clear that the drug caused any of these conditions, and they told MSNBC.com that these reports generated no new safety signals regarding RU486. So, you know, just with that little bit of thing, you would hope that with complications such as this, that a doctor, yes, indeed, should be in the same room as the patient. Now, would I like to allow abortion altogether? You bet I would. Unfortunately, this bill does not address this. This simply states that a physician must be in a room with the person receiving the procedure. And then, not only are there risks to the child during abortion, because ultimately death is ensued upon the child, but there are risks for those that have gone through the abortion, and it's something that we don't talk about rarely. It's the emotional, psychological effects that abortion has on women. And someday I hope in this committee that we can discuss that topic in depth. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, could you, and maybe I didn't hear, what is your profession?
Ms. Harris.
What is your profession? Representative Moran, I work for Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life, a nonprofit organization.
And what do you do there?
I'm a legislative associate, one of the people who works here at the Capitol.
Okay. So do you have any medical experience?
Well, Mr. Chair, I didn't go to medical school, but I certainly don't feel like you have to have a medical degree to have an understanding of the importance of not only the pro-life issue, but also the importance of a physician being in the room when abortions are being administered or performed.
Representative Moran, to the bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and this is getting there, but I need to become a little bit more informed to help me with where I want to go with this. And in your research that you do, have you talked to other physicians about the impact of taking this medication?
Ms. Harris, but Representative Moran, I would say asking about somebody's background isn't going to affect the substance of the bill. So, I mean, please continue, but let's focus on the bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, we actually have been in contact and working with physicians who support this legislation and have expertise and experience in dealing with these sorts of situations that feel like this is not an inappropriate or unreasonable expectation that a physician be on site.
Okay, Mr. Chair, but they're not here. So I was just reading that this is like a two-step process, right, where a patient takes a pill, and then 24 to 72 hours later, they take another pill. And so I guess my question is, because I'm finding maybe a disconnect here, that the effect of taking a pill may happen like 30 hours later. So I'm trying to, if that's so, why is it important for the physician to be present when taking the pill?
Ms. Harris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, for a woman who may have an ectopic pregnancy or a number of other situations that may make RU486 a potentially very complicated or deadly procedure for her, another example would be an IUD. A physician certainly should be giving her an evaluation and an exam to make sure that this drug is not going to cause a very serious complication. And without a physician able to be on site to give her a physical examination, how are we to ensure that, you know, she doesn't have any situation that would make this possibly more risky for her?
Representative Moran.
Mr. Chair, could I hear from the doctor what happens?
What happens is a patient.
Dr. Struth.
Sorry. Mr. Chair. Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Moran. These patients, prior to the decision about medical versus surgical abortion, have been thoroughly evaluated. They've been had examinations. They have probably had ultrasounds. They've had complete counseling. They've had their state required script read to them. They've had 24 hours at least of waiting period, although most women take much longer than 24 hours to make this decision before the ultimate swallowing of the pill RU486 is taken. And by the way, that the need for visualization of the swallowing is not because it's such a dangerous medication, but it's to ensure that that medication isn't taken and given to someone else. And you are right, it is a two-step process. And this bill, as written, does not exclude ectopic pregnancies, or I would not have brought that up. Ectopic pregnancies to be treated with medication are called an abortion in this bill. And so all that applies to ectopic pregnancies, whether it's tubal, cesarean section scar, corneal, interstitial, are affected by this bill, which is one of the reasons why I mentioned that OBGYNs would be felons as written. So it demonstrates a significant lack of obstetrical understanding by the medical advisors who have written this bill.
Thank you.
Representative Lummer. I'm sorry, Representative Barrett was first in line. Then we'll come to Kath.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. I think it's for Dr. House. But the question is regarding the RU486, what are the particular drugs involved in that procedure?
Dr. House?
I'm.
We need you on mic.
Great.
Thank you.
I do not order or administer SU486. I am involved in the telemedicine side. I'm an orthopedic surgeon. So okay. I think I defer to Dr. Strathy for that answer.
Sure.
Dr. Strathy?
Mr. Chair, Representative, medical abortions are performed in the two-step process as previously described. The RU486 is the first medication, and then later a second medication is given. And then typically the process completes itself, the miscarriage, the abortion occurs hours or days later. Women are followed up clinically to ensure that they have not had any complications, and if they have complications, and as can happen with any obstetrical event, whether it's a spontaneous miscarriage or giving birth, recall you're 14 times more likely to die in childbirth than of abortion, we're there for them.
Representative Barrett.
Sure, Mr. Chair, thank you. So what is the name of the second medication given during that process?
Misoprostol or Cytotec.
Sure. Mr. Chair, and the FDA, according to the Mayo Clinic, medical abortion is not a FDA-approved use of that drug. Mr. Chair, if you could, why would that be? Is it a safety issue, or is it another issue why that particular drug is not FDA-approved for this procedure?
Dr. Strathy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, a lot of medications are used outside of the FDA approval process, and this is one of them. There is a lot of studies that have been done. This particular medication is also used for induction of labor, for cervical ripening prior to IUD introduction, prior to endometrial biopsy, D&C. Cytotec is actually used for a lot of gynecologic procedures because of its cervical softening properties. The company is not taken the time or money to seek FDA approval for that.
Representative Barrett.
One quick final question. Are doctors involved physically when that particular drug is used in other areas like delivery?
Dr. Strathy.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Physicians will order the medication under the circumstances that are clinically indicated, and then either physicians or nurses will administer the medication. It can be oral or it can be vaginal.
Representative Barrett.
I think that's a yes. Thank you.
Representative Wilmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be really brief because I know we're getting short on time, and my question is on the same lines as, or my comments even, as Representative Franson. But I was just noting 14 women have died, as we talked about, and there were 2,200 adverse side effects. And I know Representative Franson sort of talked about some of those that she read from the article, but I don't know if, Jordan, you can answer this or the doctor, but can you just explain a little bit more about these adverse side effects and what women experience? Thank you.
Ms. Harris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lohmer, one of the things I think that's important to point out when we talk about a chemical abortion is that even though it starts out without a surgical procedure, Danco Laboratories, the manufacturer of the drug here in the U.S., has on their website that 5 to 8% of women will need a surgical procedure to either stop heavy bleeding or to complete an incomplete abortion. So a number of the post-marketing adverse events from the FDA, and I have the report right in front of me, is that, like I had said, 14 women have died, 612 women were hospitalized, and that includes the number of deaths. Ectopic pregnancies were 58. Experienced blood loss requiring transfusion was 339, and infections were 256, and 48 were severe infections. So.
Okay, Representative Lohmer.
Thank you. Well, I just want to say thank you so much, Representative Pepin, for bringing this bill forward. I think it's very, very important, and if we say that we want safe abortions for women, I think that this is something that will protect women. And I just want to mention, too, that when you said, you know, 14 out of 1.6 million, I just can't let it go that that means 1.6 million children lost their lives. Thank you.
Members, we're going to go another 5 minutes and take a vote. This is going to civil law. It's going to have continued discussion here in the legislature. We have two more people lined up to speak. Representative Benson.
Thank you. And hopefully this goes to the bill. My question, especially for the doctor, given the testimony, whether it's embraced by the medical community, I still have some questions about something that was brought up actually from a previous question regarding the Rochester. I know that the Rochester Mayo Clinic through their Rochester Methodist Hospital perform abortions. So I'm unclear about why there would be a need for this procedure at Planned Parenthood in Rochester. I mean, geographically, it can't be more than a mile away. So what is the additional services that abortions provide, especially in that market?
Dr. Strathy?
I have no firsthand experience. I would only be able to speculate.
Representative Benson? Go ahead, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I don't know the complete answer, but I am from Rochester, and I can just tell you that not everybody in Rochester goes to Mayo. I mean, you know, there are other physicians, and there are women who come from miles around, and there are people who are uninsured, that Planned Parenthood provides many services, health services, to women who come from all over the place who are not Mayo Clinic patients. So, you know, I don't think really that the one has to do with the other. Now, I can't really answer the question about, you know, who the physicians are that are doing the telemedicine. That I don't know. But I don't think the proximity of Mayo Clinic really addresses it at all.
Follow up. With that comment, I understand that because there's Olmsted Community and there's St. Mary's. But from the perspective of safety for the woman, and that's what this bill is trying to do, I guess I don't understand why, if someone came to Planned Parenthood seeking an abortion, why Planned Parenthood wouldn't recommend that they go to a place where the doctor's present. That's the nature of the question. You know, what is the advantage in Rochester of going to an off-site abortion from where the physician is and putting a woman's life in jeopardy? It's a comment.
Well, we do have representatives from here, but we don't have any of the medical community to answer that, and it's a little off the bill, but appreciate the question. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not going to debate abortion here. That's something the courts, I mean, that's, they're there for that. But I'm willing to consider safety concerns. I mean, talk about that reasonably. But to me, the overwhelming evidence is that that this is overreaching. It's unnecessary. But my question is about the bill, and maybe it'll be addressed in the civil, is that if this is, I mean, I've heard it mentioned that this is about protecting women as well. This is primarily about protecting women. And that, so the provisions in here where there's no cause of action against the woman, pregnant woman, but then it goes on to discuss the bill talks about identity and that the woman's identity is not, or that there's, is not protected. She doesn't enjoy anonymity in the civil proceeding. This is more for Representative Pepin question. And so it's, I mean, it's up to the judge to provide that, or, I mean, it looks like it's really just up to the judge to determine his or her own motion, or sua sponte, or other parties can request it. I don't even think the woman can request it, can she? I don't see that in here.
Representative Pepin? Ms. Harris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Allen, the sections of this bill that you had a question about, actually very similar language is currently in law in the Woman's Right to Know statute, which is a law that's been on the books since 2003. It includes the provision about protection of privacy in court proceedings, as well as a number of a very similar penalty structure in many ways. So this is something that, for example, the protection of privacy in the court proceedings and identity is currently in law elsewhere. So this is not new.
Mr. Chair. And so why is it in here? Are you changing it at all? Or
Ms. Harris.
Representative Allen, this is written into a different statute than the Woman's Right to Know law, so we just have it in this bill as well.
Mr. Chair, so you've repeated, it's just reinserted here word for word then? Is that what you're saying?
Ms. Harris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Allen, it is not identical word for word, but it's very, very similar in intent.
Okay, Representative Fritz, you have a short question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to go back a little bit in my nursing history, which is ancient maybe, but I wanted to ask the OBGYN physician about Pitocin. When in my career, when Pitocin was administered, the physician had to be on site for the entire process to administer it, and then for the pregnancy to complete. Is that still done?
That is no longer necessary. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. That is no longer considered mandatory.
And Fritz.
Thank you. And why not?
Dr. Strathy.
Because you did refer to the risks involved in a pregnancy, and I was...
And I assume you're referring to induction of labor, mm-hmm. and we have strict protocols that the nurses work under, and they work under the highest level of their licensure, and they have protocols that allow them to make professional judgments, and they manage the Pitocin, and physicians are available for questions or complications. Some are in their office, some are in the hospital, but it's not mandatory that you be in the room or on-site for Pitocin.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you for that.
Representative Pearson, you get the last word, a short question. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm not sure, probably asking, I didn't catch your name because I came in just a little bit late, but I think the question is for you. I'm reading this language, and it really talks about the civil action of a father of an unborn child can sue, and the grandmother, all practically everybody in that's related to the woman can sue if a doctor performs isn't there when this is administered. And yet down in section subdivision 6, a woman can make this decision by herself if she goes online and buys the medication, and there's no civil action against her at all. In other words, she can choose at that point in time to make a decision for herself about whether to use this particular form of an abortion pill.
Well, Representative Peterson, this is going to civil law. So I just want to mention that. It is going to civil law committee next.
I know. Okay. I know. I'll get another chance at it. I know. But my question would be, aren't we maybe encouraging women to do this themselves if they know they're going to get in all this, their doctor in trouble and all of their family in trouble? Are we encouraging women to make the decision for themselves to get the pill and to just do this by themselves?
Representative Pepin, Ms. Harris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, first, to address the issue of the civil action where you had brought up others, that's primarily for if the woman was severely injured or hurt or if she has died, so that there would be recourse for action to be taken. And in addressing the no cause of action against a pregnant woman, this legislation is about knowingly or recklessly violating, if this were to become law, the law, and it pertains to not having a physician present when this is administered, not criminalizing the woman who had obtained an abortion in this manner.
Well, Mr. Chair and Speaker, what was your name?
My name is Jordan Harris. That's okay.
I don't think you answered my question. Does this encourage women to kind of do this on their own, make their own choice?
Ms. Harris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, no. I don't believe so.
I think it's kind of contradictory, but...
Okay. Seeing no further conversation, the clerk will take the roll on the bill. I'll renew my motion, first of all. We'll renew the motion that Representative Pepin's bill, House File 2341, be recommended pass and be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. And the clerk takes the roll. The chair votes aye.
Mack?
Yes.
Abler?
Yes.
Allen?
No.
Barrett?
Yes.
Benson?
Yes.
Branson?
Yes.
Fritz?
Yes.
Grunhagen?
Yes.
Hosh?
Yes.
Huntley? Giffmeyer?
Yes.
Liebling?
No.
Lohmer?
Yes.
McDonald?
Yes.
McElpatrick?
Yes.
Moran?
No.
Murphy?
No.
Norton?
No.
Peterson?
No.
Quam?
Yes.
There being 14 ayes and 6 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is passed through the Committee on Civil Law. Thank you to the testifiers, Representative Pepin, for your bill. Okay, members, for those who arrived a little late for the announcement, we're gonna work through our list of bills here. If we have to go a little late, we will. We are not going to come back as a result. Okay, that's kind of the trade-off. We're not going to have to come back. So, Representative Mack, welcome to the committee. Do you want to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I will move House File 2060 to be recommended to pass and referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee.
Very good. Real quickly before we go to the bill, I saw that Representative Allen, I think, was interested in moving the minutes from our meeting on March 14th. Very good. Representative Allen moves the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. And a real quick shout out to the high school pages. They already left. That's too bad. They missed their recognition, but they were here. We appreciated them being here. Representative Mack, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, I would like to move the DE2 amendment to get the bill in order.
Okay, Representative Mack moves the DE2 amendments. Any comments about it, Representative Mack? Any questions from the committee? Okay. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Mack, to your bill as amended.
Thank
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be brief in my comments and then turn it over to the expert here. But members, this bill is the second part to a very exciting piece of legislation that we were able to pass last year, establishing the definition of what a community paramedic is and trying to bend the cost curve in healthcare by using underutilized services to help underserved populations. And Mr. Chair, what this bill does is it deals with the specifics of reimbursement under medical assistance and other state programs in order to allow this program to continue to move forward. So with that, I will turn it over to my testifier.
Mr. Chair, members, Buck McAlpin with the Minnesota Ambulance Association. Thanks for letting us testify on this and hearing this. We worked this fall. Last year, the legislation directed the Ambulance Association to work with stakeholders from the Department of Human Services, Office of Rural Health, the Nurses Association, Home Health, and some ambulance services medical directors to put together some payment methodologies. There was a report that came out of that. Our association with the authors, Representative Mack and Senator Rosen, drafted up some language as a placeholder, and working with DHS, who was excellent to work with on this project, we came up with what the amendment was that Representative Mack just offered. The program's moving ahead pretty aggressively in Minnesota. We have about 20 community medics that have completed the training now. There's 12 in a program currently that'll finish in June. And then we just received a grant for $250,000 from DEED, North Memorial, Alliance, and Health East, the large systems, to train 100 community paramedics over the next 36 months. So as we've worked with our partners in the health plans and our payment methodologies and have identified decreasing total cost of care and shared savings, we felt we found quite a spot to implement community paramedics and not duplicate services with our partners in home health and the nursing service. And we sure appreciate their effort on working on this bill with us the last year as we've got it to this part. And probably the neatest thing with the payment piece finished this year, we're the first state in the country to enable community paramedic as a fully functional system if we get it passed and signed by the governor this year. I'll answer a question if anybody has any, Mr. Chair.
I'll make a brief comment, privilege of the chair here. I want to thank you for doing this because this was nation-leading legislation last year and does a lot for rural health, which is a particular priority of mine. So I do appreciate what you've done with the bill and with the support it gives to rural health. Members, questions, comments? Anybody else in the audience want to testify for or against the bill? For or against this bill? If so, maybe wave your hand or make your way towards the testifying table. Okay, I'm not seeing any. Not seeing any discussion or questions. So I will. Representative Mack renews her motion that House File 2060 be recommended to pass as amended and referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion prevails and the bill is passed on to Health and Human Services Finance. Thank you, Representative Mack, and to your testifiers. Next, we have Representative Quam. Representative Quam moves House File 2128. That it be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. Representative Kahn, welcome. You have an A1 amendment, I believe?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kahn moves the A1 amendment. And do you want to tell us a little bit about it, quick?
Basically, this whole bill is an update, modernization, and compliance bill. It's been a few years since this has been done to this section. And during that activity, there was an oversight of leaving out this definition in level one trauma.
Okay, members, any questions to the amendment? Questions or discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Hosh offers the A2 amendment. Representative Hosh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A2 amendment actually comes from a community in my district in Painesville. It deals with the timing issue when it comes to credit certification by the board. They submitted that verification late, and this essentially allows them acknowledgement of that credit. From my understanding, the board is not opposed to this. There is an We can have testimony to the specifics of this, but it should be non-controversial.
Okay, any questions, comments? Representative Quam, you want to speak to the amendment?
Just that the board was aware of this, and the although we're not favoring the amendment, there's no opposition from the board on the amendment.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Quam, to your bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, one final thing. There, in the bill, there are at least four places where physician assistant is referenced. One of those one place is 11.10, where it's accidentally called physician's assistant instead of physician assistant. And so I'd like an oral to correct any occurrences with
maybe Ms. Aves could help us out with this. She knew I was going to do this to her, I think. I don't know.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, my suggestion would be to give an instruction to the reviser to substitute the words physician assistant for physician's assistant anywhere it's found in Chapter 144E, and I can write that out.
And the word physicians is without the possessive apostrophe. It's just physicians, plural.
Yes.
Correct. Physician's assistant throughout the bill. Okay. Members, you understand the amendment? Okay, it's just a the English major part of me loves this. This is very good. And I know the physician's assistant community really likes. So, yep, I see nodding heads. So, seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The oral amendment, the motion prevails, the oral amendment is adopted. And now Representative Quam to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Basically, as I stated before, this bill is taking care of many changes that have come about over several years. And so it is just a update, a modernization, you know, matching what names have changed for different positions, and also conforming with the national you know, standard of, you know, definition. Now, I have several testifiers, but we're fine with just responding to questions if they need to.
I think that would be fine. Members, questions? If any of your testifiers feel strongly about testifying, we'll welcome that. But I'm not seeing any questions or anybody jumping up. So any other person wanting to testify either for or against this bill? For or against this bill? Okay, I'm not seeing any. Members, any further discussion? Seeing none. Representative Quam renews his motion that House File 2128, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill as amended is moved on to Public Safety. Thank you, Representative Quam. Okay, Representative Lohmer. Representative Lohmer moves that House File 2627 be recommended to pass. I'm sorry, 2626. That House File 2626 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. And Representative Lohmer, I think you have a DE1 amendment.
I do.
DE1-2 amendment. And so Representative Lohmer is moving the DE1-2 amendment. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the amendment, Representative Lohmer?
It just gets the bill in the order that we wanted, or has it? So I can,
okay, very good,
explain that.
Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Representative Lohmer, to your bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2626, as amended, is legislation that will allow for the use of automated drug dispensing systems in certain healthcare facilities without going through a cumbersome variance process with the Board of Pharmacy. These systems are currently being used in hospitals and pharmacies and have been piloted in nursing homes in Anoka County. This legislation will allow their use in nursing homes, certain assisted living facilities, and some state institutions. These systems improve patient care, reduce pharmaceutical waste, reduce costs, increase accuracy, increase efficiencies, and reduce drug diversion or theft. So here to share more details of the benefits of this type of system and answer questions is Steve Langamo with Merwin Pharmacy, and Kevin Goodnow is also here to available here to answer questions about the bill. And I also want to point out that the long-term care imperative is supportive of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lumber. Mr. Langamo, could you please state your full name for the record, who you represent, and then proceed?
Yes, Stephen Robert Langamo.
And then who you represent, and then if you want to proceed?
Sure. I'm Vice President of Operations for Merwin LTC Pharmacy.
Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Steve Langamo. I'm a registered pharmacist and Vice President of Operations for Merwin LTC Pharmacy. I'm asking for your support of House File Number HF2626. The bill, as amended, allows for automated drug distribution systems to be used in nursing homes, certain assisted living facilities, correctional facilities, community behavioral health hospitals, and MSOP facilities operated by the Department of Human Services. Traditional dispensing systems in these populations use blister cards with up to a month or more of medication and are delivered from a central pharmacy that can take hours or days to arrive. Automated drug distribution systems located at a healthcare facility offer the following benefits when compared to traditional dispensing systems. Control of drugs. Each dose is accounted for. There's less chance of diversion. Increased availability of drugs when needed. Patients are treated faster. Antibiotics are used sooner, and pain is better managed. Fewer medication errors. Each med pass is clearly set up with less confusion going through hundreds of blister cards. Reduced pharmaceutical waste. Medications are filled daily or by a specific med pass. Medications that are discontinued or changed do not get filled. The best way to reduce waste is not to create it. Cost savings. All payers benefit by being only charged for medications used. And six, better quality of care. Less time is needed by the nurses for medication administration and dispensing, and more towards quality of care. I request your support of House File Number HF2626 to improve resident care, decrease waste, and decrease costs. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Members, any questions of the testifier? Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then when they're the blister packet or the cartridges, then when the med is discontinued during mid-administration of it, then does the patient get credit for that? Are they credited for that, or where does the drug goes back, and where does the money go?
Mr. Langmo.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative, it depends on the type of medication, and that's one of the benefits of this system is that it benefits all pay categories. If it's insurance, they don't usually have a good mechanism of crediting. So it depends on the type of payment system that's being used. But the benefit of this is it is across the board.
Representative Fritz.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the Medicare, is that credited?
Yes. There is certain, it depends on how it's packaged and it depends on what it is. But there are cases, depending on the package type, where they can get credit for that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fritz. Any other questions?
Correct. Yes.
Mr. Langamo.
If I could extend some comments on that. The benefit of this particular system is that there wouldn't be those extra tablets that even need to be credited because it's on a dose-by-dose basis. And so as they're accumulated, you wouldn't get billed for those, that if it was discontinued, the medication was discontinued.
Representative Fritz.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So when is this a daily
there's a
drop or weekly?
Mr. Langamo.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative. It depends on the type of distribution system. Mm-hmm. They're usually either daily or by MedPass. So it depends on how the system operates, but it's a lot less waste.
Thank you. It's good to know.
Thank you, Representative Fritz. Members, other questions, other discussion? Any other testifiers for or against this bill? Any other testifiers for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Lohmer renews her motion that House File 2626 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register as amended, and referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill is on the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lohmer, and your testifiers.
Okay, Representative Gottwalt, would you like to move
Madam
your
Chair,
bill?
I'll move House File 2627, that it be recommended to pass and be referred to, where are we going with this one?
The General Register.
To the General Register. Madam Chair, I'll also move the DE3-1 amendment.
Okay, Representative Gottwalt moves the DE1-3 amendment.
Yeah, on the bill summary, it's listed as the DE3-1, Madam Chair, but it is the DE1-3. DE1-3. There we go.
Do you want to walk us through the amendment first, or take action, get it in shape, and then walk through?
We could do it either way. Why don't we take action on it?
Okay, members. All those in favor of the DE1-3 amendment, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. The motion passes, and the amendment is adopted. Representative Gottwalt, to your bill as amended.
Madam Chair and members, you'll recall last session we heard a number of bills that became part of the omnibus policy bill. Was non-controversial. We ended up not being able to complete that at the end of session last time. What we have done is taken out any of the controversial provisions that were eventually added to it, including most of the licensing provisions. So virtually every piece of what remains here in this DE amendment has already been heard in committee with one exception. And I'll be glad to go through the whole thing, but the one section I'll point you to is Article 1, Section 2, which is some additional electronic e-prescribing provisions. It basically modifies the current regulations on electronic acknowledgments for prescription drug claims transmitting. It's non-controversial. It's a technical addition. Otherwise, all the other elements, and I can walk through them quickly if members want, have been heard before in this committee and passed last session. Again, we've pared this down. This is meant to be non-controversial. I fully expect this bill, it contains some things the departments wanted. Would hope that the governor would be interested in signing this bill. So I'll walk through it briefly. Article 1, Section 1 is Representative Scalzi's original bill, which became the omnibus policy bill. It basically has an e-prescribing exemption for two small providers. And again, that passed. The new section that I just referred to a moment ago, which includes the National Council on Prescription Drug Programs. There's peace in the valley on this. It has been run by the department. They were okay with it. Section 3 is an amendment requested last year by UCARE. It allows them to get a roster so that they can proactively go out to people who are falling off of eligibility or ending eligibility to make sure they stay on. So trying to be proactive about keeping people covered. Article 2, Section 1, former Representative Hayden, and Senator Hall brought that forward. It was requested by Hennepin County. It allowed for performance contracting language to be added to county contracts for services. MFIP family stabilization language is in Article 2, Section 2. That was a compromise from last year. Came from Nancy Selesky at MICA. NAMI and the department are good with that provision. Section 7. House File 795, Representative Hoppe, and Senate File 639, Senator Ordman, was a reciprocal child support agreement with Bermuda. You remember that one? So that is included as well. And then finally, Article 3, section on disability services. Sections 1 through 3 are long-term care imperative compromise language pertaining to customized living. And so, members, that that summarizes House File 2627. And I would I'd be open for questions, Madam Chair.
Members, any questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to know if Representative Gottwald got the trip to Bermuda to check out this provision.
Representative Gottwald.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I even toyed with the idea of wearing my banana-colored Bermuda shorts just for the occasion, but I thought better of it. I know you're all grateful for that. I know I am.
A lot of information, Representative Gottwald. Any other questions, members?
Madam Chair, with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 2627 be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the General Register.
Okay, Representative Gottwald moves that House File 2627 as amended be recommended to pass and move to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the bill passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Maybe we'll have Bermuda short day in committee, Representative Liebling. No, I'm not going there. Representative Murphy, you're a co-author on this bill, and Representative Abler is not here right now. Are you interested in pinch hitting? I don't want to put you on the spot if you don't want to. Representative Kiffmeyer is also a co-author, so. Representative Kiffmeyer, I see there was a higher level of eagerness on one side versus the other. There we go. We'll do it jointly. I like this. Very good. Okay.
Thank you. Sure. And Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House File
2223. And we'd like to move that to the House Health and Human Services Finance Committee. So moved. And then we have a number of amendments. And Ms. Aves can walk us through those in Representative Abler's absence. The first one, the thickest one, I think, is the DE2 amendment. And so Representative Kiffmeyer moves the DE2 amendment. Ms. Aves, could you walk us through this?
Mr. Chair and members, I can give you a real brief overview. The Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy regulates licensed professional counselors and alcohol and drug counselors. This is the Delete Everything Amendment substitutes basically Senate language that's already been approved into the House file. I believe this bill was heard last year in at least one committee. I don't remember whether it was this one or the Finance Committee, and there were a few things that caused concern that the board has resolved, and I think that the executive director who is sitting at the witness table can probably give you more information than I can about what those specific issues were.
Okay, very good. We have a testifier.
Mr. Chair, I think the amendment represents, the start of a conversation. There may be issues in here that we need to resolve, but if we don't move the amendment, we can't really have the conversation. So I think
how
it's important that we move this forward. And with that, I'll turn it over
Murphy,
to our testifier.
You're channeling Representative Abler. How do you do that?
Okay. Mr. Chair, members.
Who's the testifier? please state your name for the record, who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Carrie Rexigal, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy, a position I've had since 2004. I think in your information packets you may have a summary, a two-page summary that I prepared, and that really describes what this bill is doing in a nutshell. It's
I'm afraid we don't. We don't have that in our packets.
I was told.
If you have a copy, we get. Oh, no, that's not it. That's the bill summary.
Mr. Chair, if it's all, I can continue. Mm-hmm.
That would be fine. Yep, please do.
This bill rewrites the Practice Act for alcohol and drug counselors and makes some housekeeping changes to the statutes related to professional counselors. I can go into those in more detail if you'd like. They're pretty, non-controversial. It's an obsolete exam that's being eliminated for professional counselors. There are some continuing education requirements.
Ms. Rechtsigel, maybe what we could do, and this was heard last year, if you could talk about what changed. I know there were some controversial issues that have been resolved. Maybe you could highlight those.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last year, there were objections to, I believe, changing the education requirements for temporary permit holders to practice alcohol and drug counseling. So the board restored those to the educational criteria that are currently in statute. There was a group, Native American counselors, requested to have an exception to licensure, and the board did work that into the exceptions. And then this year, the deaf and hard of hearing community was concerned that we were removing specific language related to providing alcohol and drug counseling to that community. So we did not repeal those rules. And finally, the Department of Public Safety advised that even though our background investigation language had been in statute for many years, since the 90s, that we remove the reference to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, because by having it, we've never conducted national background checks. We've only done the state checks. So we agreed to take that out. And those pretty much summarize the issues that have come up in the last 2 years.
Very good. Members, any questions to the DE-1, the DE-1 amendment?
We already adopted.
Oh, no, this is the DE-2. To the DE-2, excuse me, the DE-2 amendment. Okay, seeing no questions or comments, we'll take action on the amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails and the DE-2 amendment is adopted. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I think we have an A-2 amendment.
Very good. Representative Murphy
amendment,
moves the A2 amendment, H-2223A2 amendment.
Can you just move the amendment?
And would you like to walk us through this as well?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm not prepared to talk in detail about this amendment. I believe it was language that was offered last year in committee. I believe was attached to another Health and Human Services bill, but was not enacted last year. It does affect all the health licensing boards and not just the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy. I guess it's my position in speaking solely for the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy that I'm neutral on what it does, but I understand that it changes some investigative procedures and requires the boards to do certain things in the complaint investigation process. And so I really was not prepared to talk about this amendment.
Understood, Ms. Rechtsigel. We actually had this. This was part of our omnibus policy bill last year, so it was heard in committee and passed out of committee. But Representative Norton.
Well, I'm a little uncomfortable without the author being here to discuss this particular piece. And maybe somebody else knows the answer, but as I'm looking at this, I had marked 6.19, where it talks about the conviction, and this section applies to some, but it exempts the Board of Medical Practice and the Board of Chiropractic Examiners, but applies to barbers. And so if somebody can you know, are those treated in a different way under a different statute? Are they exempted? I just don't know the answers to those things, so I guess I'd like a little bit more information from somebody. And I see the Minnesota Medical Association leaping up to come address this.
Ms. Aves, I think Ms. Aves can help us out, and then perhaps Mr. Renner, too. We're going to have lots of helplines we can go to here.
Mr. Chair and members,
Ms. Aves.
The exclusion for the boards of medical practice and chiropractic examiners is because they already have specific language like this in their own statute, right. So they don't need to be impacted by this language. And the board of barber examiners and cosmetological examiners asked to be part of this legislation.
And maybe that addresses the exception, but then is it only for the people listed? I have vague recollections of this discussion last year and saying, why is it just applying to one person? Why does it apply to everybody? And now it looks like we've added a few people, but not everyone, and so I'm just...
You know, Representative Norton, one suggestion I might make, if the author of the amendment were willing to withdraw it, I think this could be added in Health and Human Services Finance, yeah.
And then so somebody else can ask my questions and get this clarified for me, or the author can address it. I'd appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I'll withdraw the amendment.
Okay, very good. The A2 amendment is withdrawn. Okay, do we have other amendments? Nope, that's it. Very good. To your bill as amended. Representative Kiffmeyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I renew my motion that House File 2223, as amended, be recommended to pass and to be referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee.
Very good. Any further discussion? Anybody wanting to testify for or against the bill? For or against the bill? Seeing none and seeing no further questions or discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Those opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 2223, as amended, is moved on to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. Okay, members, our next meeting is tomorrow at 2:30. We will not be meeting any further today. Thank you for your good work. We stand adjourned.